All right, our last speaker for our session this morning is by Gayn Aniker on nursing ethics, ethical theory, and virtue ethics.
Now I'm going to really alarm you folks. I'm a philosopher. What's a philosopher doing at a nice science conference, huh? And even more, I realize I'm the last speaker before lunch, so I bear this heavy responsibility. I won't let you down. Okay, we can get through this. I was hoping for five people, so this is great. I appreciate it. So how does a philosopher end up talking about nursing ethics? I had the great, great privilege at, I'm at California Baptist University. I've been there about 15 years. I had the great privilege of co-teaching, team teaching, nursing ethics with a professor of nursing who handled all the clinical and professional aspects, and I handled the ethical theory stuff. Now, for those who know a little bit about the nursing world, understand I was teaching them the history of ethical theory in the semester before they would take their NCLEX. They didn't want to hear from me. They did not want to hear from me. But we made it through, we all survived, and I think they're the better for having heard a little bit of depth about what is actually now a crisis in ethical theory in Western civilization, and actually mostly around the world. It's not well understood at all. Actually, though, I think that we all feel this in our living in this culture in this day. We feel that there is some kind of crisis going on regarding ethics. So, hello, it's the big green button. Okay, so where we're going. We're going to look briefly at goodness embedded within the nursing code of ethics. We're going to look briefly at the contemporary ethical theory crisis that'll involve a brief review of modern ethical theories. We're going to look at the treatment of ethical theory in nursing ethics textbooks. And I'm going to sketch at the very end a brief outline of a Christian version of virtue ethics as a foundation for the Christian practice of nursing. This is a gentle wake-up call to nursing ethics, especially Christians in it. We understand that there's a crisis in play. Okay. Incredible, and it's wonderful. The 2018 Gallup poll, an annual poll on honesty and ethical standards in professions in America, rated U.S. nursing profession the most trusted profession in the nation. This is the way it's been ever since they added nursing to the list of professions about 14 or 15 years ago. On Gallup's annual poll of U.S. attitudes toward honesty and ethical standards of 20 key U.S. professions, respondents rated nurses with a total of 84% very high or high. This is by far the highest score of all professions in the U.S. Doctors and pharmacists with the next highest ratings were rated at 67 and 66% respectively. And the gap has only grown in recent years. So what we find is that nurses as a profession, profession-wide, and there are many thousands of nurses, are widely regarded as the best people to have involved in your lives. I've actually been in the hospital a couple of times in the last 3 or 4 years, and I am very grateful for the nurses who provided the care. And in fact, I had a couple of my students taking care of me. That was a little awkward. So I want to touch briefly on what is called the American Nursing Association Code of Ethics. It's the nationwide code, and it's a wonderful code. It's a professional code for this profession. It has 9 provisions. I'm only going to have us look at 2 real fast. Provision 1, and this is what nurses are held responsible for in the practice of their profession. The nurse practices with compassion and respect for the inherent dignity, worth, and unique attributes of every person. Provision 3, the nurse promotes, advocates for, and protects the rights, health, and safety of the patient. Those are key factors in the job of nursing, to help other people, to be compassionate and respectful of inherent dignity, These are huge, huge words, and they're at the heart of the profession. I'm amazed that as a philosopher who has to debate about everything, I mean everything, to find an entire large profession devoted to goodness like this is remarkable. It's beautiful. So the high standing is deserved, in my opinion. Clear commitment to goodness is woven into the fabric of this large, sophisticated profession. The people who make up this profession are perceived to conduct their professional lives largely in accordance with this code. Still, there is a lurking irony. The profession's commitment to goodness is seemingly floating on nothing. And that's because it appears that the world of nursing ethics does not understand the kind of crisis that's going on in our civilization regarding goodness. So we need now to understand, where did the crisis come from? What is the crisis? And so we now need to do a bit of the history of ethics here. I'm going to be using the words morality and ethics roughly interchangeably. There are slight flavor differences, but if you look at the histories of the words come from two different languages. Ethics is Greek. Morality is Latin, but they have about the same meaning, namely, how we should live our lives. So there are only flavor differences in our current usage. Try this. If you have a strong violation of a professional code of ethics, you've probably lied, cheated by stealing money, expose people to risk that you shouldn't have exposed people to risk. Even though we call those ethical violations, that is immoral behavior. Okay, we don't have a headline, person convicted of immorality, but it works out about the same. So in philosophy, we use the words largely interchangeably. So in ancient times, where did people have a sense of how they should live their lives? They get it from tradition and from religion. And actually, in almost all ancient cultures, tradition and religion are intertwined. So it's kind of a package deal. If you look at Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, those stories that they would tell around the campfire, those stories taught them how to live. The notion of what it means to be a good man, a good woman, are embedded in all the stories. A lot of the negative stories are stories of the gods misbehaving. So you can see the intertwining of religion and tradition. The overwhelming emphasis in ancient morality is on character, not on actions, but character. Of course, they're related, but in ancient morality, character comes first. What kind of person you are in the moral dimension. Character is taught through the acquisition of virtues. Virtues, we'll say roughly, are habits in one's life that make one a better person. For example, the cardinal virtues, courage, practical wisdom, temperance, justice, and so on. The emphasis on character and virtue continued in Western civilization even as Western civ became Christian. The Bible is largely about character when it comes to the moral dimension. There are definitely rules, but the real thing is what kind of person you are. You find this in Proverbs, you find this in Psalms, you find this in Jesus and in the Apostle Paul. It was easy for Western civilization to maintain an emphasis on virtues and character well into and through the Middle Ages. But now we get to a turning point, the Renaissance and the early modern period. Beginning in the Renaissance and continuing into the modern period, tradition and religion began to be marginalized as sources of knowledge and wisdom in society. This marginalization was largely a consequence of the dramatic rise in the authority of mathematics and the natural sciences within civilization. Now, please understand, I'm not dumping on mathematics and natural sciences. They're wonderful. We've all been beneficiaries of the tremendous advances there, and so praise God for this. This is really, I actually believe it's the working out of God's creative activity that leads us to understand mathematics and natural sciences as we have, and so this is an outworking of God's work in our lives and in civilization. But not everybody responds to this development in the right way. It began to be thought that if you were going to do any kind of proper thinking, you had to think like a scientist or a mathematician. Your thinking had to be systematically and rationally organized the way it is in science and math. Now, as an ideal, it's not a terrible thing to strive for as much as you can, but the question is it really going to work for all the dimensions of human life? Now, when I say that in the last 500 years, religion and tradition have been marginalized as sources of knowledge in the West, the word marginalized is a soft word. It really means religion and tradition have been increasingly denigrated, openly denigrated, as of any real value. And we all know that. We're very, very aware of that. But it's had a really disastrous consequence in the world of ethical theory. By the late 1700s, intellectuals began to realize that the marginalization of tradition and religion left the civilization without a rational foundation for morality. Remember, up to that point, and including that century, morality was thought to have been woven into the fabric of the culture from our understanding of human nature and character. But when the challenge comes, prove it or discard it. Prove it in a rational, scientific, mathematical sense, or discard it. The pressure was to discard. And it took a while for people to realize, oh my gosh, we got no basis for ethics any longer. We just tossed it out the window. Several philosophers began to propose philosophically based ethical theories to provide a rational foundation for morality. Those secular, rationally based theories began to appear in the late 1700s. Jeremy Bentham was one of the earliest, with a very early crude form of utilitarianism. There were six or seven secular theories proposed in the next couple of hundred years. Only two of them really stand out in large-scale understanding these days. The structure of these modern-era ethical theories seemed to be influenced by the methodology of the natural sciences. And now here you're going to get my one formula. Here I am, a philosopher. I'm going to give you a formula, okay? Don't you like that formula at the bottom of the page? Isn't that great? And actually, remember, I gave you two numbers in the second slide. So we got numbers, we got formulas, we're good. So the two theories that have really made a serious run at legitimacy are the theory called deontology, proposed by Immanuel Kant, roughly we can say 1800. Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill got started on utilitarianism a little earlier, but really utilitarianism flourished after deontology was presented and really widely examined in the mid-19th century. Both ethical theories conform to the general paradigm. You have the theory. It's actually a fairly simple statement of theory. You load in specific conditions, and then you get an assessment of an action. Is the action right or is it wrong? Notice we've switched now in moving from classical understanding of morality, which focused on character, what kind of person you are. We've switched to a focus on, are actions right or wrong? That's a big, big shift. My guess is that part of the reason for the focus on actions is the thinkers thought that they were easier to assess than one's overall character. It's easier to get an assessment of, is this a good action or not? Okay, now we have to do a slide or two on each of the moral theories, and this is kind of going to be a little bit fire hose-like, but you'll live. Immanuel Kant presenting deontology, the word deon in Greek means duty. Kant believed that acting from duty alone was the only moral motivation for action. And we have his famous categorical imperative. This is his formula. This is his formula for what morality consists in. Act such that the maxim of your act could be made universal law. Okay, what's a maxim? That's a rule. Act so that if your act were to be turned into a rule for everybody, everybody could perform the act without undermining the practice. Here's an example of how this works. Kant thought that if you wanted to lie and you had to turn that into a rule for everybody, you would say, okay, everyone can lie whenever it will be convenient for them. Now, Kant said you really can't successfully universalize that rule because it would undercut the practice of lying. How would that undercut the practice of lying? It would destroy the trust necessary for a lie to be successful. A lie can only be successful if people trust you to be telling the truth. But if everyone knows you're going to be lying whenever it's convenient, no one will trust, and so the rule would undercut itself. It would be self-destructive. Kant thought that every wrong practice could not be put into a universalized rule that could be successfully practiced by everybody without undercutting the practice itself. That's the idea. It's a brilliant idea. I love it. And actually, there's something right about this. We think that the idea that you shouldn't be allowed to do something on the edge if everybody can't do it, we think that that's part of what we mean by fairness. And Kant built his entire theory on this. Okay, brilliant. And it deserves attention. It deserves consideration. But the question is this formula, just a few words, does this really capture accurately all of morality, and does it work? Okay, one slide on utilitarianism. Now, this is, you understand, people are writing books and books and books, thousands of books and articles on this stuff, so this is an unbelievably shallow dip. The principle of utility, I'm going to use Bentham's formulation. It's really crude, but it's nice and clear and makes the point. The measure of right and wrong is the greatest happiness of the greatest number. Okay? On this theory, an act is right if and only if it yields the greatest happiness, always operationalized in terms of pleasure. He uses different words, but when it comes right down to it, we're talking about counting pleasure and pain. On this theory, an act is right if and only if it yields the greatest happiness for the greatest number over against other possible actions. Okay. Now, there are a lot of things wrong with this theory, a lot of things wrong, but I believe there's actually also something right about it, and that's the real challenge. Okay, the authors of both of these theories claim that their theories were complete. By that they mean totally defining right and wrong, completely addressing all matters, and universal, applying to all moral questions everywhere. These theories, therefore, are mutually exclusive. If one of them's right, the other has to be wrong, and vice versa. Or they might both be false, which I think is the case. And actually, most philosophers now think it's the case. Outside the world of philosophy, few are aware that a consensus has developed over the last 60 years that both of these theories fail for different reasons. Many serious objections have been made to both theories over the last 150 years, their adherents have attempted to defend them, but ultimately without success. It really has developed in the last 50 years that people are saying, we tried to make them work for a couple of centuries, and they just don't work. They just don't satisfactorily encompass morality. For Kant, the most serious flaw is that the theory simply is not a reliable guide to moral decision-making. Any number of clearly immoral acts can pass the universalizability test. Now, you have to craft the rule, the maxim, carefully. For example, lie whenever it will benefit me, and two, it's unlikely that my lie will be discovered. Now, actually, that's the rule that most of us function on when we lie. And I admit, I've told a lie. lie whenever it will benefit me, and it is unlikely that my lie will be discovered. According to Kant's theory, this act becomes my moral duty because it actually can be universalized without undercutting the practice of lying. People still lie because most people still trust most people who are talking to them. Okay? So Kant's supporters have not been able to fix up the theory to survive that kind of objection. Bentham and Mill's utilitarianism, the critique is a little easier to see. The most serious objection is the principle of utility can easily be seen to justify any number of deeply immoral actions. Here's a classic example. You'll find this in every textbook. Utilitarianism still cannot satisfy this objection without ceasing to be utilitarianism. Suppose 10 people are shipwrecked on an isolated deserted island. If 9 of them make the 10th their slave to perform all the undesirable work, it is entirely plausible to suppose that the pleasure of the 9 will outweigh the profound displeasure of the 10th. According to the theory, it is a right act for the 9 to enslave the 10th. Utilitarianism has not been able to fix the theory so that it survives against us. By the way, just note, in both these cases, against Kant and against utilitarianism, in both cases, we're presuming to know the kinds of outcomes that a moral theory should have in order to have a real claim on our lives. There's an assumption that we know what goodness means, and this theory isn't delivering it. That assumption has got to be factored into your understanding of morality. If you don't factor it in, you're being cheesy. And actually, so both Mill and Kant didn't address that issue. So these and many other objections to deontology and utilitarianism have been debated for 150 years. No advocate of either theory has been able to overcome these debilitating objections, though many have been attempted. The strong majority of philosophers have concluded that neither theory is viable, and they're beginning to move on. But the result for our understanding of morality is this, and this is what, this in bold, this is what you feel when you live in contemporary civilization. There is now no widely accepted theoretical understanding of the foundations of ethics. The strongest secular candidates are no longer considered viable. I don't know if you know the name John Rawls. He was a great philosopher at Harvard who was going to be producing a new moral theory. This is about 35 years ago. Everybody was waiting because everybody was realizing, okay, Kant and Bentham and Mill have problems. What's Rawls going to do? Fell flat. So there are no viable candidates now. So now we flip back to nursing ethics. I'm prepared to do chapter and verse on three classic textbooks in nursing ethics by Aiken, Burkhart and Nathaniel, and Butts and Rich. There are many other texts, but they're all about the same in this regard. They all give one chapter to virtue ethics. It's amazing. They give one chapter to ethical theory. Here's what they run into. Regarding ethical theory, these nursing ethics textbooks fail in several ways. Problem number one. By the way, there's lots of good stuff in all these textbooks. There's lots of good stuff, but they fail with regard to ethical theory. They fail to understand that deontology and utilitarianism claim to be complete and universal theories. Instead, these textbooks treat these theories as different but complementary tools in a toolbox. So in this ethical decision involving consequences of an action, apply utilitarianism. In that decision involving duties, apply deontology. There's actually some wisdom lurking in that, but no one is openly saying these are failed theories, and so we're going to have to try to take parts of both and create a new understanding of morality. There's no sense of that at all. Problem two. These textbooks fail to realize that modern era ethical theories are no longer considered viable. The theories do not work. They often deliver unacceptable results. The theories are each limited in different ways, involving only a single aspect of moral deliberation, ignoring other key factors. The theories ignore other important dimensions of moral life, including the dimension of moral education. Problem three. Because of problems one and two, these textbooks do not properly connect ethical decision-making to the deepest aspects of human life. They avoid the elephant-in-the-room issue that apparently ethical theory has little to do with the key values and virtues that properly frame and motivate nursing practice. These six virtues that are listed at the bottom of the screen, respect for persons, justice, non-maleficence, respect for autonomy, beneficence, and veracity. These are the heart of what it means to be a really good nurse. These are the heart. And the ethical theories of Mill and Kant don't remotely connect to these six virtues with any real solid clarity. It's really amazing. And so for you, for nursing ethics professors to be writing these textbooks talking about ethical theory, but then really saying these six values and virtues are the heart, there's no connection. So the nursing textbooks need to go back and rethink what they're up to in discussing ethical theory. Here's what an ethical theory should be up to. An ethical theory should reveal the essence of morality. It should show how morality works in our lives. It should show how morality is connected to the deepest understandings of life. It should help us make difficult moral decisions and help us understand the complexity of morality. But these textbooks don't do any of these things. Now, all of these features that I've said of a successful approach to moral theory, they're really doing the important job of helping to create confidence that morality is real and objective. It's not something we make up. It's not something we invent. It's not something we it's not something that is really insubstantial. Okay, I know I'm out of time. I want to just sketch a couple elements of what I think Christians in nursing should be thinking about in terms of their theoretical understanding of their moral obligations. Crisis presents an opportunity. Christians in nursing and Christian schools of nursing can embrace the opportunity to show how their ethical theory flows from and contributes to their Christian worldview. A Christian approach to virtue ethics has been developing in the last 50 years. It's a wonderful development. Actually, virtue ethics is the biggest deal in ethics in the last 50 years. And it's really exciting. Our character consists of virtues, vices, values, sentiments, and attitudes. These are all things for which we are morally responsible. And I tick through all those things, but if you want a copy of this PowerPoint, you just ask me for it, I'd be happy. Now, another thing that needs to be added to a proper moral theory is what theologians refer to as natural law. According to Christian faith, God is the true source of all goodness and all of our knowledge of goodness. He has created us to know His law in the very fabric of our nature. The Christian view of natural law is that it is the objective, intuitive understanding of good and bad and right and wrong shared by all people. This understanding can be suppressed or marred in people's lives. A great strength of Christian worldview is that it possesses a powerful and integrated explanation for the widespread shared notions of good and bad, right and wrong. Romans 2. This is the Apostle Paul. Indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law. That means they were not given the law at Mount Sinai. They show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness in their thoughts, sometimes accusing them and at other times even defending them. Another element of Christian virtue ethics, if we're going to be biblically faithful, is that it's got to involve some place for moral rules. I mean, what are the Ten Commandments? Those are rules. In my opinion, a proper Christian virtue ethics has to not be just pure virtues. It has to have virtues based on natural law with the cooperation of rules and laws. This still counts as a virtue ethics, since the primary question is one of moral character, the kind of person you are. Much remains to be done. Most needed is careful work on moral decision making. Moral decision making in tough cases is really hard, and there is no formula for it. Kant and Bentham should be embarrassed. There is no formula for making those tough decisions. So there's a lot left to do, but this is a start, and I thought it would be good to let some people know about what's happening in terms of ethical theory in the world of philosophy. Thanks.
Well, we are closer to lunch than everybody who's got sessions over in the other building. So if you would allow a couple minutes for questions, I'd be glad to.
Oh, you meant closer to lunch in terms of physical proximity, right?
Proximity, sure. We are the ones closest.
Everybody's the same in terms of time. A little relativity difference, maybe.
Yeah.
But
Hey, thank you for that. So I guess it occurs to me that for verses, simply reading a chapter in the textbook is not going to be sufficient for virtue ethics or taking a single class. That a lot of this stuff needs to be happening when they're young. This is a lot of formative stuff.
Oh, right. That's right. The idea, by the way, what I've said here about nursing ethics is probably the case for all professional ethics, business ethics, legal ethics, medical ethics, all that. None of them know what to do with ethical theory. And by the way, most philosophers don't know what to do with ethical theory either, so we're floundering. Having left our biblical moorings, we're floundering. So there's the idea that a single course is going to produce ethical people in the profession is ridiculous. We're formed in our understanding of goodness from the very first day. And so actually working on moral education, working on family stability so that a solid family instills the values and virtues in a child as the child grows, that's the most important thing. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just to thank you, I taught engineering ethics.
There you go.
Exactly the way you described the textbooks. As these are some options, and if you try this one, if that doesn't work, try that one.
The toolbox.
And I didn't know that was wrong. So
no. Listen, I'm open to the understanding that to ask professional experts to master something that the philosophers are floundering with, it's not fair, okay? I get it, it's not fair. But everybody needs to know what the problem is, okay? We got a problem. Western civilization is in a deep crisis with regard to its understanding of the roots of being a good human being. It's partly it's mostly a function of having left God. Okay. And any others? Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'm just kind of curious if in the nursing profession, in the medical profession, in the AMA sort of ethics, and there's a variety of different things that have been kind of going on with regards to using that as a tool to influence certain kind of practices in medicine. Are there things like that happening with regards to nursing too? And if so, what are some of the kinds of, and what are sort of the dynamics that are at play in nursing that may be different from doctors?
Okay, a couple of dimensions to that. I want to say that in all the professions, I'm not a great student of all the professional fields in their ethics, but I get a sense that everybody has an understanding of goodness, and that the profession, if people are lying and the lies cause people to die, that's bad. And there's widespread recognition that that's bad. I say praise God. That's God's law written on their hearts that is telling them this is a bad thing that's been done. So in all the professions, including medical ethics, there is widespread understanding of goodness. But here's the problem. No one acknowledges or tries to account for in any realistic way where that goodness comes from. And that's deep, deep bad faith in the sense of lying to oneself. I think it's secular people lying to themselves that they are actually largely embracing goodness in the professional dimension, but they are denying the reality where it comes from. So there are lots of good things going on in nursing. In nursing, it applies more to caring for people and how you provide proper care, whereas I think in medical ethics is far more working on scientific details about pulling the plug and so forth. Medical ethics is more technical. Nursing ethics is more care oriented.
There's one more, but we're going to have to stop so we can go to pull on too much, but let's thank her. And as I said, the PowerPoint, the slides will be available online.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.